The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What this press conference shows is that, somewhat predictably but still horrifyingly, Trump is psychologically incapable of accepting defeat, and that the only way he can process defeat is by thinking, truly believing, and I suspect he really truly believes this, that somehow he has been cheated. And if he believes that he has been cheated, then he will spend the next 2 months, while he is still in office and still has the full powers of the presidency, taking it out on his enemies. And a president can do an enormous amount of damage in 2 months. Yeah, even a lame duck president.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 6th, 2020. It's election day, day three. The votes are almost all counted, but they're not quite all counted. We kind of know where the electoral votes are going, but some of them haven't gone there yet. We think we know the outcome. We think it's inevitable, but we don't announce things before they're called. So we're going to try to talk through the next several days without ever saying what is clearly the elephant in the room. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio at 9:33 in the evening, which is the latest we have ever recorded a Lawfare podcast, David Preece, Chief Operating Officer of the Lawfare Institute, Scott Anderson, Senior Editor of Lawfare, and Alan Rosenstein, Lawfare senior contributor, and I believe the founder in some great spiritual sense of the Lawfare podcast. It's the Lawfare podcast, November 6th, almost done. Scott, get us started. Where are we in the process of figuring out who's going to be the next president? How much is really still in contest? Are you, as the political analyst Dave Wasserman would say, have you seen enough, or is there still a real question here?
My freshman year of college hallmate, Dave Wasserman, we're at the point now where the map looks a lot like what we were looking at yesterday. We're still waiting for final calls or results from Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, as well as Alaska, actually. And there's a little bit of an interesting story that's kind of hopped up there, more relating to the Senate race, although I guess it could have implications for electoral votes as well. What we've really seen is some tightening around the margins. At this point, Georgia looks incredibly close, while Pennsylvania is still being counted, and President Trump still has, I think, around 2 percentage points edge there by most counts. The ratio at which it's been shrunken, the number of votes outstanding, has led a lot of contributors who are following and projecting to say pretty confidently that it's going to end up in Biden's corner quite comfortably, and by most accounts, in fact. Arizona has narrowed, and in kind of an unpredictable fashion. It seems that people think Arizona may be one state that may in fact flip back to Trump, reversing some early calls that some prognosticators made, particularly the AP and Fox News. Nevada, meanwhile, has remained kind of outstanding, remains relatively close in an absolute count sense, but has gotten broader for Biden there, and the mail votes appear to have matched the sort of pattern that we've seen, in that they tend to lean towards Biden, and that's predominantly what remains to be counted. So that's increasingly seen as a safer sort of Biden column. call. In a number of these cases, these are states that maybe would have been called, except at this point, calling any of them would mean calling the end of the election in a lot of ways. But for Biden in particular, North Carolina is one that, you know, could get called for Trump, has been consistently in his column. I think as people see as the least likely to go in Biden's direction of these five. But, you know, it's still also outstanding in part because there are some outstanding votes there. And I think at this point in the race, people are waiting for a 270 electoral vote maker before calling it, and particularly one that is by a comfortable enough margin that they can say confidently, yeah, this is the state of things. We're not going to have to reverse any of these calls anytime soon down the road. So that's where we are right now.
David, I sort of feel like everybody kind of knows that Biden is winning this and is mm-hmm. going to win this mm-hmm. and that there's this thing that we can't say it because we don't know that any particular state is done. Right. And so, like you say, is some combination of Georgia, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Arizona going to end this thing for Biden? You can say with extremely high confidence that, yes, that's going to happen. But because you don't know the actual sequence of it or the actual composition, mm-hmm. people are being reticent about saying what is, in fact, quite clear. Is that fair?
Yeah, there's two reasons we can't say it's done. One is that, which is it is mathematically possible, and it's unlikely, but history and experience and statistics tell us it does happen sometimes that very unlikely events occur. It is statistically possible that the expectations of votes in Maricopa County in Arizona, in Philadelphia County, and in the suburbs of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, and in the remaining votes in Georgia, it is possible that all of those could suddenly defy expectations. He's not mathematically out of the woods yet. So that's one reason we can't say it's over. The other reason is an ethical reason, which is if you are saying full-throatedly, as many people are, President Trump, you cannot go out there and say the election is over. You cannot go out there and say we have won because every vote counts. We need to count all of the votes. You can't turn around and then say, well, Biden has already won the election. Yes, it is statistically highly likely, and it would be a very, very rough path for Trump to win. But I find it hypocritical of people who are saying that Donald Trump is out of bounds by claiming he has won, and then turn around and say, Biden has won the election. No, he hasn't. That's part of the reason we need to count every vote.
Alan, before we get into the meat of stuff, do you have anything to add to this? Do you agree with David that it is the better part of valor to honor the idea that we should just sit tight and hold either the sackcloth or the champagne, depending on your point of view, until the networks call enough states to get to 270?
I do. I'm looking at the New York Times front page right now, and the banner headline is Biden urges patience, Trump lies about count. And that to me pretty well encapsulates the dynamic and the contrast between the two candidates. And frankly, if Biden's going to win, as he is likely to, and I certainly hope he does, then he's going to win whether it's tonight or tomorrow or the next day. And I think that at this point, the sooner we get to the next chapter of American political history, which is the rebuilding of democratic norms post-Trump, the better. And I think, ironically, the longer Biden waits to declare victory and the more he relies on the standard process, which in this country is, you know, some combination of state secretaries of state and the major media outlets, the better it will be. So I'm quite okay if this drags on for another day.
All right. So let's talk about the events of the day and then some sort of broader themes of this election result. I want to do this in not necessarily in order of importance, but in order of the sequence in which they happened. First major thing that happened today was a set of litigations that the Trump campaign brought Scott, walk us through the litigation state. It seems like this really isn't Florida 2000. What is it?
So we're seeing the Trump administration continue this strategy of deploying litigation in a kind of throw it against the wall strategy, deploying a wide array of arguments in a number of different jurisdictions that, frankly, at least from my view, seem almost entirely aimed at the delaying tactics and then a messaging system, a way of both living up to the president's promise of pursuing litigation and fighting this through the courts and feeding this narrative of the election having been stolen somehow. The day after Election Day, we saw a filing in which the Trump campaign sought to join an existing matter before the Supreme Court regarding late votes in Pennsylvania. That's still pending now. But again, that doesn't actually impact the votes that are really being counted now. That's about electoral votes that might arrive after Election Day that are going to be being segregated out and will be counted later if that's necessary, to the extent of how the litigation goes. We saw litigations get filed yesterday again in Michigan and in Pennsylvania that sought to delay the count there on the grounds that observers weren't being allowed adequate access to the counting process. That effort was failed in Georgia, although it may be pending appeal. In Pennsylvania, it failed before the trial court. An appellate court then stepped in and actually granted the appeal, did not stop the count, which was the remedy the Trump campaign was seeking, but did say, okay, you have to provide a little bit more access, and that implementing that did slow the count slightly in Pennsylvania, although I think for a matter of minutes to an hour, not a long-term pause that the Trump administration had been pursuing, but that's being very much trumpeted as a sort of victory by the Trump campaign at this point. But that is now on appeal to the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, who says that the new restrictions the intermediate appellate court imposed put the workers at risk of coronavirus transmission, and therefore they're pushing back against that, which is the original reason they had it, part of the original reason they had it spaced a little bit more. We also saw a threat of litigation brought in the state of Nevada aimed at federal court as threatened, basically alleging that there were upwards of 10,000 fraudulent votes, people voting from out of state, people voting who don't have a right to vote in the state of Nevada, capitalizing on concerns and, frankly, pre-election day litigation that was pursued by the Republican Party there, leveling criticism against Nevada's move to a pretty much entirely vote-by-mail sort of system in response to the pandemic. That action, I believe, is still kind of pending, but like other sorts of actions like this, it's a large scale, and this is particularly a large scale allegation of an idea that you are seeing this large-scale fraud without any evidence really being brought forward. There was an encounter between Rick Grinnell, a campaign official, former ambassador, former acting intelligence chief, who was there as kind of a surrogate for the Trump campaign, who made an announcement and was confronted with this and didn't really choose to engage with the media on providing any sort of evidence of these sorts of allegations. We also know there's another lawsuit in Georgia, and maybe combined with the other prior Georgia suit, I'm actually not sure. Again, looking at this idea of whether a certain number of votes were being cast past a particular deadline. It is, again, ballots that were not received after Election Day. A Trump campaign saying these were being counted improperly. That was, again, struck down by a Georgia court, not struck down, kind of rejected by a Georgia court. We also saw, outside of the context of just litigation, but in terms of other challenges, an apparent resolution for the time being to what's been called Sharpiegate, this idea that in Arizona, a certain number of voter ballots were being rejected because of the use of Sharpie markers. We had the attorney general in Arizona investigate this, send a letter earlier this evening saying they found no evidence that there's any substantiation of these sorts of allegations or that in any way disenfranchised Arizona voters. And then on top of that, the kind of final cherry on top of the sundae of different legal challenges is the recount request in Wisconsin that's been threatened by the Trump campaign. But by my understanding, however, it hasn't actually been pursued yet. They have to wait for Wisconsin to finalize their vote count before they can pursue a request. And in part, that's to ensure that the final count is within the 1% threshold for pursuing the most conventional route to a recount there. So we're seeing lots of action on a lot of these different fronts. The key point is none of these are things that actually promise to upset the outcome of the election, with the possibility of the Nevada claims, but they're just so out there and so unsubstantiated, it's hard to see them being successful without some way more substantial evidence for allegations. And there again, the Trump campaign is pursuing this remedy of stopping the counting. It's not clear to me how that would help if their allegation is that thousands of these ballots have already been counted. If that's true and they have evidence of that, then they're going to have to do a recount anyway to go back and filter out these fraudulent ballots. And so interrupting the counting at this point doesn't really accomplish anything towards remedying that goal. Instead, it is just another way to slow the outcome of these races. And I think that looks like it's the main objective. They're trying to stop this media narrative that is leading towards people eventually calling the election for Biden. And right now, all they can do is delay that date and try and buy themselves more time to find other ways that they might be able to tilt things back in their direction.
But just to follow up on that, what is the strategic value of delay? If, you know, at the end of the day, in the Florida 2000 controversy, you had a vote, if you were Bush, that you were ahead in, right? And you were trying to stop a partial recount designed to disrupt the election victory that you had on the initial count. Here, they're trying to stop the initial count altogether. What does that get them? If you stop the initial count in Nevada, you lose. I mean, I suppose the theory is you'd trade Nevada for Georgia and Pennsylvania, but is there a discernible principle here?
I think it boils down to three possible explanations, none of which are mutually exclusive. One, it is just a pugilistic instinct of this president and some of the people surrounding them that their attitude is to go in as sharp of it as possible, like a bull in a china shop, not caring what you break along the way to try and get your way. And this seems like at least postponing them definitively not getting their way. The second part of that is it does give them genuinely more time to try and come up with another strategy. Maybe that strategy is trying to challenge some of these ballots before they get counted in some manner, get people in place to do that, find, get legal victories that will allow them to do that. But, you know, to get that, they've got to gather some sort of evidence that there's some sort of issue that they can piece together some sort of argument. Delaying it also just gives them time to make it look like the process is dragging out, to cast the process as illegitimate, raise more doubts about it, spread misinformation. Is what it is about how the process is actually proceeding, and try and turn perhaps popular opinion against it in a way that might undermine the election, and then perhaps even legitimate some more extreme action to sort of address it in the end. Whether it is, you know, these sort of outlandish theories that having Pennsylvania step in and a state legislature appoint electors as opposed to abiding by election results. Again, that seems very far-fetched now. But as you note, it's really hard to see what you actually get strategically from this. A lot of it, I think, is just serving the narrative and checking the boxes that President Trump has put forward. He came out on election night and he said, we're going to go to the courts, we're going to fight this tooth and nail, and I won. And as has been throughout this entire administration, when President Trump says something, the people around him usually try and make reality look as much like that as they can. And I think that's the task we're seeing here. I'm not sure it's driving to much of a strategic outcome, but if it is, it's some of those more, you know, outlandish scenarios that I think people have talked about, which I see is very unlikely as succeeding if they were to try them, and very unlikely that they'll get people to go along to try them. But it may just be the last kind of line of hope that they have in front of them at this point.
All right, that idea of litigation as an expression of presidential temper tantrum brings me very nicely to the second thing that happened today, which was the president gave his most unusual, I think even for him, this was a sort of outlying press conference statement, you know, a couple hours ago. That was presaged by this display that the former director of national intelligence, Mr. Grinnell, made in Nevada. David, talk to us about the temper tantrum side of the president's and his handlers' temper tantrums.
Woo, where to begin? The president did something that many of us thought he was capable of tonight, but I think many people hoped that he just wouldn't go there. Nobody expected he would come out and make a statement gracefully conceding, given that there still are open questions. But I think many people were hoping that he would just say, you know, well, I'm not giving up and I think I've won and all of those things that candidates sometimes say in a situation like this. But of course he didn't. He came out and talked about the fact that he'd already won, claiming Pennsylvania, claiming counting legal votes that he easily wins, and then saying, if you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. And that's worrying in two fronts. One of them I don't know if he's even aware of, which is a growing meme on alt-right media today, I think banned by Facebook eventually, but still circulating on the gabs and parlors out there, which is the Stop the Steal movement circulating among some of the dangerous groups out there. And with his language about counting the illegal votes will, you know, steal the election from us, it's enabling and empowering that movement, which could come back to haunt all of us. Even without that, though, we have a president talking about votes being counted that are inherently illegal because they're turning against him. That's unhinged. That's something beyond the pale in presidential history. And of course, I found myself, as I'm wont to do, going back through my head of previous presidents and what have they done that has been egregious or awful to the extent like this. And when it comes to things like the way they handle political opposition to them, we have a very long history going back actually to the 1700s of visceral, nasty things being said about each other in elections. But we didn't have a John Adams or a Thomas Jefferson claiming that it was an illegal result from an election. I went back to somebody that I thought was one of the worst presidents in our history, which is Andrew Johnson. And even before his impeachment and the trial that happened of him in 1868, a couple of years before that, he did something unprecedented for the time, which is as president, he went out on this speaking tour for 19 days, giving something like 100 speeches, which was not common. And he used it to do things like vilify his opponents, to praise himself in almost messianic terms, and even say that, you know, why not hang Thad Stevens, one of his most visceral opponents on the other side of the aisle. This is somehow worse than that, though, Ben, because that was still in a partisan governing the presidency, they're stopping each other's policies context. In this case, it's about accepting the results of a constitutional process itself. And I have found it interesting, both before and after the press conference, to see the separation that's happening within the Republican Party or those affiliated with it today. You mentioned Rick Grenell. Rick Grenell, who is proving that he really was outside of his element as acting director of national intelligence for a brief period of time and has reverted to his core existence as a Twitter troll, is taking his tour live. Instead of just tweeting out nasty things and chewing up his opponents, he actually had a briefing in front of a polling station and accused election officials in Nevada with no evidence of covering up incidents of voter fraud to deliver Biden a victory there. And when asked questions, he refused to defend the claims or offer any evidence, and in fact just walked away from reporters after essentially tweeting orally in the session. But that wasn't the worst of it. Steve Bannon, I understand, has now been banned on Twitter because he called for FBI Director Chris Wray and for Dr. Anthony Fauci to have their heads put on pikes as a demonstration to others. Metaphor or not, that's one side of where the president's supporters have gone today. The other side is actually interesting, the kind of thing that many of us thought we might see before the election. Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, a representative out there saying very strongly, no, this is the legal process. We will count every vote, essentially saying, stop it, Mr. President. This isn't right. You've also had a bipartisan group come out and just this evening and talk very forcefully about the need to count every vote and commenting directly on the president's speech at the White House tonight and calling them false claims that undermine the integrity of our elections and do a disservice to the hardworking election officials around the country. And this is the so-called National Council on Election Integrity that was pulled together rather quickly. It has some of the usual suspects you might suspect saying this against Trump, like a Madeleine Albright or a Carol Moseley Braun, but it's got people like General James Cartwright, Dan Coats, the former DNI, Barbara Comstock, who people in the Washington area know as a Republican representative, former Republican representative from Northern Virginia, Carlos Curbelo, and Mike Rogers, former NSA chief. You have people finally coming out and not just holding back on supporting the president, but actually speaking out quite forcefully against this new action. Of course, the people in the middle are the ones that are more alarming. You know, what is Mitch McConnell really going to say and do? What are the senators who have just won re-election going to really say and do? I haven't seen anything from Susan Collins. I expect she's disappointed and concerned, but I don't see her actually coming out and criticizing this. But we are seeing some separation. To me, that's interesting, but I'm not sure what it is beyond that, because the majority of the people coming out and criticizing it are people like Congressman Will Hurd, who is leaving and is not coming back to the Congress because he decided not to run again, or former officials. Adam Kinzinger actually stands out in this regard. So to me, the display at the White House tonight is hard to process. We've never seen a sitting president do something like this. Because of it, however, it may actually be motivating some of the people who need to be the equivalent of the Republican leaders in 1974, who went to Richard Nixon at the White House and said, "You're done. You don't have support from us. There is an end game here, and you're in it." I'm not sure you'll get that delegation going to the White House and saying it in quite the same way, but we might be seeing a movement towards that simply because of how egregious his behavior was tonight.
I've seen the same facts I think David sees, but I've actually think we've seen like a little bit of a very depressing and dangerous shift in Republican reactions in the last 24 hours. I will say this, you know, Axios put together a list of an article that's headlined "Republicans Rebuke Trump Over Baseless Election Claims in Response to the Speech" that several hours ago. The only Republicans who are actually in office and staying in office past January, they're able to quote on this, are Kinzinger, Mitt Romney, Paul Mitchell, and then Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, who, you know, is not necessarily, doesn't play a role in the presidential selection process. Other than that, it's a bunch of retirees or people who are on their way out. We're not seeing many Republicans speaking up and condemning this. To the contrary, we saw earlier today, Lindsey Graham, recently reelected Senator Lindsey Graham, get on Fox News and essentially say, "Oh, I trust Arizona. I don't trust Pennsylvania," providing legitimacy to a lot of the president's claims, saying he's donating $500,000 to the president's defense campaign. You also frankly see a lot of major figures in conservative media. Of course, you have Gorka and Bannon who have come out saying, speaking violence. You even had Tucker Carlson on Fox News earlier today saying that people, Trump supporters, have guns and will, you know, say something to the effect of make blood run in the streets if things keep heading in this direction. You also saw Tommy Tuberville come out and join kind of Lindsey Graham in a little bit stronger terms, to using a very bad football metaphor to say essentially that it looks like the Biden campaign is stacking the deck. There are a lot of major Republican figures who are getting on board with the Trump administration's narrative yet. Not a ton in an absolute sense, but if you stack them up against the people who are actually in office are going to be decision makers, against those who are speaking out against the president, I suspect you're going to get pretty even stacks. And that's really scary. That should be a really scary development, because these are the people who are in the most direct position. And at this point, they're adopting a narrative of facts that, even if it's quite departed from reality, can justify a lot of bad behavior. And to me, I actually think that's the most disturbing thing that I've seen happen in the last 48 hours where we've been watching this election unfold.
Just to add one thing to what Scott was saying, for me, this press conference, which I can only describe as bananas, I think that's sort of the only word that fully captures the insanity of what we all saw during it, really underscores not just the danger right now in terms of Trump and his enablers whipping up doubts about the election, but also it's a really bad sign of what's going to happen in the lame duck period. What this press conference shows is that, somewhat predictably but still horrifyingly, Trump is psychologically incapable of accepting defeat, and that the only way he can process defeat is by thinking, truly believing, and I suspect he really truly believes this, that somehow he has been cheated. And if he believes that he has been cheated, then he will spend the next 2 months while he is still in office and still has the full powers of the presidency, taking it out on his enemies. And a president can do an enormous amount of damage in 2 months, you know, even a lame duck president. And so I'm not terribly concerned that Trump's antics, whether the press conference or the fairly ridiculous legal campaign, quote unquote legal, given, as Scott pointed out, the real lack of merit in any of these arguments, I'm not terribly concerned that this is going to change what's going to happen in the next 12, 24, or 48 hours in terms of calling the election. And I'm not concerned that it's going to change the Electoral College count, the Electoral College vote, and inauguration. But I think it is a really bad sign for what we're about to see in the next 2.5 months from, you know, the wounded king, as it were, lashing out in the last few months that he has to do so.
Yeah. So what does that look like? We wargamed that a little bit yesterday morning, but what are your thoughts if you were the wounded, cornered animal, Donald Trump, and you had all the powers of the presidency until January 20th at noon, whereupon instantaneously you have none of them? What do you do for the next 2 months?
Well, I think one thing you do is you pardon everyone you can think of. I mean, I think we are about to see a pardon spree, and a frankly quite obviously corrupt pardon spree, like we've never seen before. Trump has no shame about using pardons for his own personal motives. He has no interest in going through the standard pardon process. And so I think he is going to probably retroactively pardon himself, because why not? He'll pardon his family. He'll pardon his inner circle. He'll pardon anyone remotely connected to his inner circle. I think that's certainly where he'll start.
You know, I think this can go one of two ways, and a lot of it boils down to the president himself and how he's going to react to the situation. I don't think we have a super firm idea about that. One possibility is that Donald Trump takes defeat very poorly on a personal level, but reacts by turning inward and isolating himself and essentially, you know, retreating to Mar-a-Lago, taking his phone with him. I'm sure there'll be a continuing, you know, tirade of tweets, but, you know, hands off a couple of key matters like pardons, like a few other key matters he's going to need to wrap up to key officials in his administration, but largely disengages because he's lost. It's an embarrassment and maybe psychologically difficult to bear. In a lot of ways, that's the best outcome from my view. People are still going to do, I think, things that I certainly disagree with on a policy front that are probably nefarious and maybe probably inappropriate and poorly motivated, as Alan spelled out on a number of fronts. You know, lower level Trump people will do that. It's not just the president who will do that as well. But, you know, I do think there's plenty of people in the administration just don't have an incentive at this point to be right outright obstructionist or causing problems that may complicate the transition or really further undermine and injure institutions when they're not being directed to do so by the president. The concern is in the other alternative, where President Trump is angry and wants to keep fighting. And when he can't fight, does what we've seen him do multiple times before, which is where he feels like somebody hits him. He says expressly, "I hit them back harder." And he keeps taking these lashes. And we have 80 days of just continually eating away at the legitimacy of the process, the legitimacy of the incoming administration, and these ideas. That doesn't mean the Biden administration isn't going to be the president. Joe Biden's not going to be president on January 20th, 2021. I think by all odds he will. And I don't think there's much that Donald Trump can do about it, quite frankly. But he can do a lot of damage along the way in a lot of big and small ways. And, you know, it's all about how much he actually wants to do it. I don't think that many people would be motivated to do that without his drive. But if he's directing them, I don't think many are going to push back against him.
Yeah, I hate to play this role, but because it's not my norm or my comfort zone, but I feel like a bit of an optimist on that front, and maybe that front only, Scott, because I mean, the damage that Trump has done to the institutions that we care about over the last almost 4 years are already so much. I don't know what the difference is in the next few weeks, especially when you have more people than you've had before, perhaps since the first weeks of his presidency, who are interested in actually protecting some of those institutions because they realize a new president is coming in. So I'm slightly more optimistic, not that he won't try. In fact, maybe I go even darker than you do on that, but that there will be more resistance, more just ignoring him, more what I, you know, used to call, you know, removing the president in place by simply ignoring what he does. as people did to some of Nixon's craziest orders and as people have done with Trump throughout his presidency. I see more of that coming in the next few weeks. But I am curious, Ben, for your thoughts on this. I mean, you co-wrote a book about Trump and the presidency and all the ways that he's changed the norms and all of this. So what do you see him doing in the next few weeks?
Well, I agree with Alan that we're very likely to see a spree of highly abusive clemency actions. Those are zero cost to him. So, you know, you do them because why not? It's a way of sticking your middle finger up at people. It's also a way of theatrically rewarding loyalty, right? You can wave your wand and make Michael Flynn's problems go away. You can make George Papadopoulos's problems go away and sort of support his claims of vindication. And so I can't really see why he wouldn't do that. I have to say, as disgusting as those actions are, they are relatively harmless. The less harmless actions involving the clemency matters would be to pardon people who were, you know, whom he might be aware of and we are not, who may be being coerced, may leaned on to cooperate with other investigations, you know, in order to avoid implicating Trump. I don't know if any such people exist or any such active investigations are, but, you know, if you could get to potential witnesses and pardon them, that is a much more aggressive use of the power. I also think we are likely to see a spree of firings. Those have been, you know, there have been talks of firing or removing from his position Tony Fauci, Chris Wray, and, you know, even without, as Steve Bannon disgustingly put it, beheading them, you can, you know, really send a message to people in the bureaucracy about, you know, the costs of disloyalty.
But what's the real effect of those, Ben? I mean, if I understand Dr. Fauci being gone would be bad, but there's no doubt if he wants his job back, he gets it back on January 20th, about 5 seconds after inauguration. But what's the effect on the bureaucracy of somebody who is gratuitously fired by the president on his way out the door? Isn't the message actually the opposite, which is, okay, let's appreciate a sane, reasonable president again?
That may be right. I mean, I suppose the other thing you could do is the thing that the Trumpists were convinced that the Obama administration had done to them, which was embedding a whole series of political people as career people.
Right, right.
Now, I don't really believe that's all that consequential an action. But look, the appointments and firing powers are one of the most powerful positions the president has. Using it effectively has never been Trump's strong suit, but I don't doubt, you know, look, you know, John Adams had his midnight judges, and that was a pretty consequential thing. And so, you know, I don't think there is zero impact here. I also think that, you know, there are lots of countries around the world that are going to take a look at this period as an opportunity to do mischievous things in their regions. And the capacity of Donald Trump to mishandle one of those things is always a dangerous thing. And then finally, you know, don't underestimate the impact of simply running a bad transition. If you run a bad transition, the next administration comes in with a little bit less visibility, a little bit less effectiveness, and it's hard to trace negative impacts to that. But there is a difference in short-term governance effectiveness for the new administration, whether its predecessor helps with a good transition or not. And I think we can all reasonably expect one will not happen here. So, Alan, I want to close with some thoughts of yours on the question of how we should feel about this election result. So on the one hand, those of us who are, you know, have spent the last 4 years wringing our hands with concern about the state of democracy and, you know, our institutions and sort of rule of law in the government and were thus hoping for a kind of full-throated electoral shellacking of Trumpism by way of sending a message about what is politically viable in the United States, you know, are a little bit disappointed with a situation where he almost won. His congressional enablers largely did win with a certain set of exceptions. Mitch McConnell is very likely to be the Senate majority leader come January. And Republicans actually seem to have gained a few seats in the House, although not fundamentally changed the power arrangements there. And so you kind of look at it and you say, well, you know, this was not the renunciation of Trumpism and all its works for which one would have prayed. On the other hand, you know, defeating an incumbent president is a really hard thing to do. And Joe Biden won. So how do you understand this on the in relation to your mental win set?
I think it's I think it's complicated. I felt pretty despondent for a while. I mean, I felt pretty panicked on election night when Florida came in, and I thought that maybe this was 2016 all over again. But even when it became clear that Biden was probably going to pull it out, the relative closeness of this election, as you point out, is disappointing, because it does not represent a real repudiation of Trumpism. And it shows that there's just a huge portion of the electorate that does not find a kind of ethno-nationalist authoritarianism to be disqualifying. And that is disappointing, to say the least. At the same time, I'm not sure how useful disappointment is. And once you've internalized it, once you've used it to update your views on the nature of reality, the nature of the electorate that you're dealing with, the nature of the society that you are part of and are trying to improve, I think you have to get over it. And that's what I've been trying to do as sort of quickly as I can. The last few years really drove home to me that, and this is a cliche, but it's a cliche that is, I think, hard to internalize, that democracy is not an endpoint. It's not something you reach as a society and then you can relax and go to the beach and not worry about it. It is a constant process because it is fragile, and the entropy of social and economic conflict is constantly eating away at its foundations. And so it's something you have to fight every day. And every day that you are able to fight for it, and every day that it survives and allows you to fight for it the next day, is by definition a good day. And I think that's the attitude you have to adopt to be constructive. And look, at the end of the day, Trump, and hopefully this will be officially called very soon, Trump will have lost this election. Joe Biden, a man of fundamental democratic decency, will be the president of the United States. And so we will be able to fight to continue American democracy for at least another 4 years. And then if in 2024 we have to deal with Trumpism again, we'll fight it then. And then we'll fight it the next time. And we'll fight it the next time. So it is obviously disappointing, but I think the sooner we can get past that and recommit ourselves to the struggle, the better. There have been periods in American history where democracy has been weakened, where democracy has looked quite uncertain. And those generations that we now look back with pride, the generation that fought for the North in the Civil War, the generation that rebuilt the economy in the Great Depression and that fought in World War II, I mean, these are our greatest generations. And we can be disappointed that we face our own profound challenges, or we can decide to take that disappointment and try to become our own greatest generation. And so that is what I'm trying to focus on, because to be quite honest, the alternative, which is to really contemplate what it means for so many Americans, who I really do think, you know, are fundamentally decent people, and you know, but for certain demographic or cultural differences, are frankly not that different than those on the other side of the political spectrum. The fact that so many Americans, for whatever reason, are willing to vote for someone like Donald Trump, when the alternative is someone so patently inoffensive as Joe Biden, I think focusing too much on that alternative is depressing and dispiriting, and that's just not where I want to spend my energy.
So I agree with everything Alan just said, but I do think we should look and think a little bit about the outcome here in less of a binary when it comes to the relationship between the electorate and Trumpism, because in a way we did see a rejection of a particular type of Trumpism, in that we saw President Trump significantly underperform other much more conventional Republican candidates, even as he was overperforming himself and other Republican presidential candidates in certain ways, at least in terms of an absolute vote count. There's obviously some part of the voting public that President Trump has tapped into, who he's been able to mobilize and bring out, that votes for him and then votes red down the ticket. And then there are people who are willing to vote for Republicans, are willing to vote for Republicans even who kind of went along with Donald Trump, maybe somewhat more or less enthusiastically, people like Suzanne Collins, who beat her projections and won by a hefty margin in a state that overwhelmingly went to Joe Biden and the other party on the presidential level. That sort of split signals something. And it's something the Republican Party is going to have to think about. There are parts of the Trump package that bring real windfalls in terms of mobilizing that particular base that's really helped Republicans, particularly in this race and really for the last 4 years. And that may include a lot of, you know, ideas that a lot of people, including myself, think are dangerous and bad. But it may be what gets people out the door. Then there are also parts of the Trump package that scared voters away. And it's going to be Republicans now are going to try and parse that and figure out, well, can we get a candidate who maybe is just less completely, you know, brusque or less rude or less personal, has less of a complicated and pretty hypocritical personal life, or frankly, is just less incompetent than Donald Trump, but nonetheless embraces some values and ideas that mobilizes those new voters that Donald Trump does appear to have been able to bring into the coalition. That is not a complete repudiation of Trumpism. If anything, it may be a new motivation for institutionalizing some form of Trumpism, but it may still a rejection of perhaps President Trump himself. But it probably is the beginning of what we're going to see about what is going to be a new version of the Republican Party that's going to look a lot like Trump, but is going to have some changes towards a more conventional model that, again, outperformed him in the end of this election.
We're going to leave it there. David Priest, Scott Anderson, Alan Rosenstein, thank you all so much for joining us this late in the evening. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Special thanks this episode to Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, who bore with repeated changes in the time of the podcast as we kept pushing it back. You need to do your part to support the Lawfare Podcast, and by support, I mean tweet about us. I mean share us on Facebook. Join social media's companies you have never been a part of in order to share the Lawfare Podcast. How many of you have shared it on Parler, for example? You should buy merch at thelawfarestore.com. You should leave us a review wherever you found us. And of course, you should say a special thank you to Jen Patya Howell, who produces and edits the Lawfare Podcast today as every day, and to Sophia Yan, whose music is playing us out now. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.